All right. Thanks for your patience. I don't know what's up with my laptop today, but it was uncooperative. But thankfully, we have a solution now. So today, I'm going to talk about permacomputing and aesthetics, and then how that relates to especially Libre graphics, but free software in general. And I might occasionally, I hope nobody's offended, but I might slip back and forth and use the term open source when I mean free software. And anyway, you can grill me later about it. Okay, but I think it's important to note that, like, a lot of times when we talk about technical things, we seem to talk about them in a way that's very rational, and we don't maybe occasionally forget that this is also culture that we're talking about. So that's why it's kind of important, I think, in this context to talk about aesthetics. So I also should maybe reflect some limitations of, you know, who I am and some of the other people who are involved with this. You know, it's not a result of bad intentions, it's just a simple fact that when a small group of people do something, then they will have a particular background, and they won't necessarily be representative of a wider public. So I'm aware of that, and I think it's good to reflect about that. And sometimes it can be a problem, but it's not necessarily a bad problem. It can be an exciting problem to address. Okay, so let's talk about the general digital aesthetics. Here's a contrast that I kind of like to make. This image on the left, you probably know, that's the Apple UFO headquarters. It looks like a very anodyne object that came down from space. And then here on the right, you might not recognize it, but this is like this sort of endless sprawl of strip malls and parking lots and chain stores and whatnot. That's actually Cupertino. So if you imagine you turn the camera around from the UFO, which looks like it's sort of sitting in nature surrounded by trees, that's sort of, in some ways, this idea of aesthetics, you might argue, is codifying maybe a little bit more that than the idealized form of the UFO. But even if we go back to the UFO, the aesthetics of at least the commercial digital world is kind of, I would go so far as to describe it as anti-biological. Like, it's very, when you see advertising for a modern smartphone, usually it looks, there's no sign of any biology anywhere in it. Like, there's no sign of anything alive. Like, it's this sort of shiny, weird disco in space, which has no people in it. You know, it's just this sort of, it's everything, every object and every surface is completely artificial and smooth. And yeah, it's a bit of a problem if we're dealing with the fact that consumerism and all this digital culture is kind of destructive to nature, then maybe part of it has to do with the aesthetics that are implicit in the thing. And then another problem here, I don't know, I think some of the people in the room might not be old enough to know this reference. It's kind of old now, but it's this, it was actually an ad campaign from Apple where, I mean, you could reduce it to saying, like, yeah, which white male would you like to personify your idea of, you know, digital consumerism, you know? And it's very normative, and I think most people kind of see that as a little bit of a problem, if not a huge problem. So we're going to talk about, so with permacomputing, one of the things that we get into is the idea of embracing limitations. And so normally we think about constraints. So if you use the term constraint in, say, mathematics, you know, we just talked about B-splines, and biology or mechanics design and stuff, it's sort of normal to talk about constraints in the terms of, you know, addressing a particular problem. And our lives are, you know, they're full of constraints. You know, we're just dealing with these sort of limitations and things all the time. But when you say the word constraints or limitations, people often, it has a negative connotation. People associate it a lot with a sort of limitation on your freedom. And there's this idea that is kind of a little bit toxic that's built into a lot of consumerism, is that if you buy this thing, then you'll be free. You won't have this constraint anymore. And this ends up going back to this, what some people call this sort of maximalist aesthetics of this sort of, you know, perfect, unlimited resource idea of digitality. And it's an idea that we can somehow, through this sort of perfect technology, then be free of constraints. But permacomputing is more about actually not just accepting the constraints, but sort of embracing them. And so one way of thinking about that is that artists and craftspeople are always working with constraints. No matter what, you always have some sort of limitations, whether it's the material or your tools or the time or something like that. And so one thing that's really fun for us in this project was to go through a lot of like classic stuff in, or not obscure stuff even, in art history to look at that. So I don't have much time, and I wasted a lot of time getting the projector to work, but I'm going to try and blast through a few examples which I think are fun and somewhat related to graphics here. So here is, this was something called Video Journal in the Czech Republic, or at that time it was the Czechoslovakian People's Republic of Czechoslovakia. It was in the 80s, people made a bootleg video magazine using the video equipment in schools and then sort of, you know, passing this around. It was sort of subversive and not allowed, but they used this sort of limited equipment. This is another idea of constraint. So in dealing with like copyright, so I don't know if you know UbuWeb, if you're interested in a lot of like sort of art historical stuff, it's really great. It's this wonderful sort of kind of random, but also nicely curated archive of a lot of sort of classic art historical stuff, so video art and things like that. And some of the video art here, if a museum wanted to show one of these videos, they would have to pay a licensing fee that would be like thousands of dollars, you know, because these are famous works. But because they are hosting this on a web server that's in Mexico, and it's a tiny, like 320 by whatever, like a sort of pixely grainy version, nobody really cares for the most part. And the few times that somebody then did complain to them, then they were like, oh, okay, sorry, we'll take it down. And then that was it. But it was a way of sort of working with copyright by constraining the quality of the resolution. This is a sort of, I mean, everybody knows about the Bauhaus, but there was some sort of parallel movements in the beginning of the Soviet Union. The first few years were, there was actually quite permissive in terms of experimental art and architecture and design, and these were some artists and architects who were really interested in pursuing this sort of modernist visions of stuff, but they had literally no money and no access. Like, this school had, you know, almost nothing. They had just gone through the revolution, and so they basically went to the dump and got scrap wood and metal and made these quite amazing modernist sculptures. Another similar idea of material constraint, and here I want to be a little bit careful, I don't want to get too much into romanticizing poverty, this is still a problematic scenario, but it is kind of amazing the way somebody, this artist, has gone to dump sites and scrounged all this electronics and then repurposed it and built it into new works. Another one, this was in the 1970s, the United Farm Workers who were striking, they took this is like extra wide accounting printer paper, like computer printer paper, and they used the back of it to silkscreen their posters for their strike campaign. And then another one, I think if people are into plotter, that I know that's become kind of cool and interesting, and that's, I think, part of the attraction of a lot of this plotter art is that it is a very constrained medium. And here's Vera Molnar, who also not just using the constraints of the plotter, but also decided to constrain herself intentionally, not just because she had to, but because she wanted to. She decided to only work with squares. And so that was also an interesting idea of constraint. Typewriter and ASCII art, long tradition of also doing really interesting aesthetic graphics with constrained stuff. Here is a 4K PC demo, and it's not 4K because that's the resolution, it's 4 kilobytes. So, the sort of European demo scene, as it's called, has this tradition of making super small, super optimized, very kind of flashy and fun vernacular artworks. And so the point of all this is to show that there's a sort of irony of limitations, that the limitations actually end up resulting in more interesting work, I would argue, than if they didn't have these limitations, that this stuff wouldn't have happened if somebody hadn't sort of been like creative with the situation that they were in. And the other thing that's interesting is it's a bulwark for diversity. So it's not just that, we aren't landing in this sort of I'm a Mac, I'm a PC thing. We're landing somewhere where things are kind of wild and frankly diverse because of the contingency of these different situations. And so here, this was one, I'm really into woodworking, so this was like these different kinds of saws that you see, like a sort of Japanese saw and a more continental European frame saw and a panel saw, which is more like Anglo-American style, and then they have also different styles of woodwork. I don't want to say that that's why their woodwork is different, anyway. But I want to say that the constraints also have a big role to play in the diversity of the outputs. And it also leaves space for kind of what I would say a weirdness. I don't know, maybe I'm getting into some, but I think that's one of the things that is also important is to, at least in an aesthetic world, if everything becomes monocultural, that's kind of depressing. So I think this is also an enabler of that possibility. Of course, limits are arbitrary. You know, you could also argue that whoever is using the latest, most expensive NVIDIA GPU is also working with constraints, which is true, you know. And permacomputing can't just be, I don't know, a vague reference to constraints. It's got to have a connection back to this environmental concern. And that's what the reason why we're interested in constraints is because if I'm buying a new PC every 2 or 3 years and throwing it into the trash, I think we know that's creating a lot of problems. And it's not just that. There's a whole a wider knock-on effects. But what we can say is that constrained aesthetics drive ethics. So if I'm deciding to accept these constrained aesthetics, then it also means that I'm working with e-waste, that I'm thinking about the limited availability of hardware, of energy, and I'm thinking about computational objects, you know, instead of being these sort of more or less disposable consumer things, that I could even think of them as almost like an heirloom object, you know, like a nice piece of furniture that you could keep and pass on to your kids or something like that. Also, maybe the idea of using more natural materials. And then it's designed to be, ideally, if a piece of hardware is related to that, then it would be designed to be repairable and maybe reflect my own sort of individual cultural situation. So I'm going to go through some examples that are either framed as permacomputing or people have started to see them in that context, because this term is kind of new. This is one I think some people might be familiar with. There's a studio in, they're on a sailboat actually in Canada right now. They call themselves 100 Rabbits, and they sort of basically, some of it was as a result of the bandwidth constraints of being on a sailboat, basically decided to reduce their footprint to a sort of virtual machine. And they've kind of reinvented the wheel in a lot of ways, which has been interesting for them. So they make their own sort of simple vector and pixel graphic tools. And they're, I think recently they've been doing more stuff with like windowing interfaces, things like that. But it's a platform that basically is a virtual machine that looks a lot like an 1980s console or PC. Here's another one. This is from Iodine Dynamics. It's a video. It's a new game for the NES, the original NES. And the way they went about it was that they developed the game on PCs using emulators, but then they got a bunch of old, junked, basically some game that nobody wanted, that had like zero resale value, and then they put their game, so they burned, so you can actually buy the cartridges and play them on the original Nintendo. Of course, you can also play it on an emulator, but the idea was that they didn't want to produce any new e-waste. This one is a little bit of shameless self-promotion. It's something that I've played with for a long time, the Screenless Office, which is basically a system that I have where you can do a lot of interactions with media, mostly using print and barcode scanners and things like that. And because there's no screen, it works on basically any old hardware that can run Linux. So I usually run it on like cheap, like 10-year-old Raspberry Pis and things like that. Here's another one. There's a small file. There's several small file festivals. So there's a small file film festival, and then there was a small file photo festival. And the main constraint was that you just had to make a file small enough. I think for the film festival, it was like five mega, or they had maybe several categories. So there was like the longer films could be up to 10 megabytes, and the smaller films would be 2 or 3. I don't remember exactly the categories. But it was quite interesting to see some of the stuff that was going on there. Here's one which in some ways is very spectacular. You know, you think of these kind of, I don't know, stadium techno events where people have, I don't know how many 4K screens and giant renderings and things like that. But this is something that was in a similar type of context. So it was Robert Henke is somebody who's been in this sort of techno and electronic music scenes for a long time. But he made this sort of large, very, in some ways, kind of classic techno-style projection, but only using these CBM 8032 PCs, which are 8-bit computers from the 1980s. I think they didn't even have color, so everything was sort of two-color, black and white, and very reduced geometries, but it was pretty well accepted by the crowd. The MNT Reform is another project to build. So this is actually new hardware, but the idea is that it's all user serviceable, open hardware, and it's upgradable, and it's pretty well made. So the idea is that it would last a long time. And then there are a lot of examples that we've started to get more interested in of what we're calling everyday permacomputing. And this is actually a Commodore 64, which is, last time I checked, I don't know, this was a couple of years ago, but it was still in use in a car repair shop in Poland. And it was sort of like whoever bought it set it up at some point, and it worked, and they never saw any reason to upgrade. And it's fairly reliable hardware, apparently. So, that's also the thing that I think a lot of, I would suspect most of us do on some small level. You know, if you have like an old laptop or an old, an iPod or a phone that you put post-market OS on it, or old servers that you sort of keep running, any of these things you could frame in some way as sort of everyday permacomputing. All right, so I'm running out of time here, so let me just quickly get through. I'll just blast through these. So consider your work in environmental terms. That's something that I think everyone can do, and if you're working on free software, or if you are using free software, that might be actually something you could even brag about. There was a recent case where KDE came out, and basically, because Windows is now saying that you have to throw away your laptop if you want to run Windows 11, And so KDE was saying, well, you could just get rid of Windows and put KDE on it. So it's an interesting, maybe a twist that you could make here. Another thing to consider is like different temporalities. So a lot of stuff that's sort of classic consumerist stuff is based on this idea of, I don't know, almost like being like a 19th century factory owner. Like you gotta be as fast and efficient as possible. But some stuff is slow and maybe that's kind of nice and okay. And that relates to an idea that we've been thinking about, because if you want, when like the term degrowth in some ways is kind of maybe a bit toxic. So if you can think of things in terms of savoir-vivre instead of savoir-faire, that you can maybe sell it better, that it's just nicer to do things this way, that it's more fun, it's more pleasant, it looks better, it feels better, rather than it's economically rational. All right, so I will leave it there. We have a few websites. The main permacomputing wiki is at permacomputing.net, and the BBS is a brand new, since a few weeks, or almost a month, I guess. It's a web forum. And otherwise, get involved. This is it's a community of practice, so it's very open. Okay, thank you.